You're listening to Amphibicast.
This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by Grey Ghost Creations. Specializing in unique wildlife art for lovers of reptiles, amphibians, and arachnids, Grey Ghost Creations offers a wide variety of art prints, stickers, pins, necklaces, and more. To find more unique original art, be sure to visit Grey Ghost Creations on Etsy at www.greyghostcreations.etsy.com. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I am your host, Andrew Bates, and this week I have a very special guest. I have Crystal Mandika of the Amphibian Foundation, and we're going to talk about all the tasks and the jobs, and she wears many, many hats at the Amphibian Foundation and does a tremendous amount of outreach, and she also manages the whole collection there. So we've got a lot to talk about. I'm very happy to have her on the show tonight. If you may recall back, I had Mark Mandika, her husband, on the show. It's always a pleasure having Mark on. And I'm looking forward to chatting with Crystal. We've got a lot to cover. But before we do that, of course, the usual stuff. I want to thank everybody for the reviews. 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify goes a long way, helps the show get out there to a bigger audience. And if you want to support the show, some great ways to do so are to become a patron on Patreon. I have tiers as low as $1 a month, and the most popular tier is the $5 a month tier. That'll get you a shout-out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And if you follow the link tree, you'll also find links to the merch store if you want to buy some t-shirts, stickers, and I also have a link to In Situ Ecosystems Vivariums if you'd like to make a purchase through there. You get a 10% discount if you make the purchase through the link. And I think that's it. I'm ready to get going. Crystal, how are you tonight? Thank you for coming and talking to me.
Dan, thank you. I'm wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's been a long day here for me, but I'm happy that we've got some time to chat.
Me too. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So you do so much at the AF, but I want to kind of, you know, find out about your story. What was, like, how did you get into this? Well, what were some of your earliest experiences with amphibians or just the natural world in general, and what led you to where you are today?
Yeah, my introduction to amphibians actually came pretty late in my life. It wasn't until I met Mark, my husband and the co-founder of the Amphibian Foundation, in my late 20s that I learned what salamanders and Sicilians were. So originally, I only knew about frogs and toads, because I grew up in Miami and there are no salamanders or Sicilians there. And actually, Miami, there are only invasive frogs. And I didn't know that at the time either. So when I met Mark, he introduced me to the world of amphibians and amphibian biology. And I was completely fascinated. I had no idea that amphibians could be so interesting. And the more I learned about them, the more I wanted to interact with them.
What was the invasive species in Miami? Was it the Cuban tree frog or was it something else?
Yes, Cuban tree frog. And I think there are probably cane toads down there as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Gotta love Florida.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing natural anymore, unfortunately.
And you two ended up in Georgia. That's the location of the Amphibian Foundation now, right?
Exactly. We're in Atlanta, Georgia.
Did you two end up in Georgia first, or you just settled on a location and moved there once you decided where the Amphibian Foundation was going to be constructed, I guess?
Well, it's kind of a little bit of a backstory. So we first, we're married in Miami, Florida. We spent some time there, but we realized that we really didn't want to raise our family there. So it worked out that Mark was offered a job at the Atlanta Botanical Garden. And so we're like, oh, that's great. That's amazing. It gets us out of Miami, gets us to somewhere different. Atlanta seems fantastic. And the Atlanta Botanical Garden seemed like a great opportunity. So we ended up moving to Atlanta for him to work at the Atlanta Botanical Garden. But then it turned out that the garden discontinued their amphibian conservation program. And so that meant that Mark no longer had a job. And so that's when, you know, Mark and I sat down and we realized that the amphibians that he was working with, the ones that were so imperiled, were not going to get the attention that they needed. So we decided that we were going to start our own nonprofit organization. And that's when we decided to create the Amphibian Foundation.
And how long did it take from the original inception, like from the moment that the two of you said, all right, let's do our own thing, let's create our own organization? What was the timeline from that until the point where, I guess you'd say you opened your doors, we'll call it that?
Yeah, sure. So in 2016, goodness, we sat down and we're like, okay, this is what's going to happen. This has to happen. So we had no actual place to go. We started the Amphibian Foundation in our basement. And so, of course, that really wasn't a sustainable situation. So we were actually really fortunate enough to be approached by Nancy Jones, the founder of the Blue Heron Nature Preserve here in Atlanta. And she asked if Mark and I would bring the Amphibian Foundation to the Blue Heron Nature Preserve. So I think that was probably 2 or 3 weeks after we, you know, signed our paperwork to become a nonprofit, that Nancy reached out to us and invited us to come and be a part of the Blue Heron Nature Preserve. And she so believed in our mission and what we were trying to do that she offered us rent space there, you know, like rent free for 6 months so we could kind of get our feet under us and establish ourselves.
And the collection that was at the Atlanta Botanical Gardens, you mentioned that they, mm-hmm. I guess, closed down their amphibian operation. Did that collection go with the two of you?
Yes, at least our most priority species, and that was the frosted flatwood salamanders. So we were fortunate enough to have the backing of U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and so they said, you know, we trust you with these imperiled species, and we want you to take care of them, so we're going to give them to you. And we actually had them in our basement for the first few weeks of the inception of the Amphibian Foundation until we got our space at the Blue Heron Nature Preserve.
And how many animals did you start out with? Like, what was the original basement collection? What did that consist of?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. So it was only the frosted flatwood salamanders. And I believe we had about 30 individuals. Yeah, 30 individual salamanders.
That's an awesome basement. I'm just picturing it. That must have been the two of you must have been the only people in the world who would have been able to have them in your home. I mean, obviously it was, you know, for a conservation purpose, but
definitely.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation to get in.
Yeah, we had to fill out a lot of paperwork to be able to house these critically endangered species, these salamanders, in our basement. And we were just so thankful that U.S. Fish and Wildlife entrusted us with these salamanders, you know, and thought that we were the best people to care for them.
So what were some of the challenges that you faced in the beginning? Because, no project, whether it's a business, a charity, a podcast, whatever it is, obviously there are obstacles and challenges from the beginning. What were some of the challenges that you two faced, you know, from the beginning, and how have you adapted over the years?
Oh, gosh, yes. Raising money was definitely a big challenge for us in the beginning. And that's definitely still a challenge that we have today. So as you can imagine, you know, caring for amphibians and reptiles is expensive. So every animal has its own sets of needs, and providing for those needs is, you know, constant and pricey. So definitely making sure that we have enough money to do what we do on a day-to-day basis is one of our biggest challenges. And then, of course, over the years, we've really come to rely on on our volunteer help to take care of our over 1,000 animals. And I've got to say, like, we've got the most amazing volunteers, and these are people that are committed to the well-being of our animal collection. But, you know, finding the right people can be challenging. Finding the right people with, you know, the right scheduling can be challenging because, you know, we have our specific volunteer hours and not everybody's available during those times. So it's challenging to find the right people at the right times, but it's really rewarding to be surrounded by so many people that believe in our mission.
And did you build a physical facility from the ground up, or did you use what's there, and did you grow as time passed?
Well, I would say we came into the Blue Heron Nature Preserve building. We came in and they gave us an empty room and said, go ahead and build what you need for your amphibians. And so we put together our amphibian lab from scratch, and then brought in our frosted flatwood salamanders, and then we started collecting even more and more animals that we wanted to work with, whether it be for research or education. And so over time, we have grown tremendously from those, you know, 30 individual salamanders that we have to now we have over 1,000 animals that we care for at the Amphibian Foundation.
That's amazing.
It is.
I want to address that as well. But I mean, besides being collections manager, you're also co-founder, obviously, director of education, bookkeeper, collections manager. You do a lot. you have a lot of jobs. I was wondering if you could tell us about each of those roles and just walk us through a typical day in terms of, you know, when Crystal walks in the morning, you know, what is it like, what's an average day for you there at the Amphibian Foundation?
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, I have several roles at the Amphibian Foundation, but I really think that that's kind of like the nature of the beast when it comes to running your own business. You know, I'm not the only one that does a lot. You know, Mark does so much too. I would say my first role that I consider myself is, you know, the director of education. So I develop programming for children ages 0 to 17. And, you know, with our education program, we really strive to reach as many children and families as possible. We hold classes for neighboring schools. We host field trips at our location, and students are able to come and just learn about amphibians and reptiles. And then we lead nature surveys on the preserve, and we do virtual classes as well. So that's huge for us. One of our most popular educational initiatives that we have is our amphibian and reptile camp for kids. That's called Critter Camp, and that's one of my personal favorite things that we do. And so each summer we hold 10 weeks of camp, where each day is dedicated to learning about a specific animal group. So the campers like feed the animals that are set up in the classroom, learn to take care of them. We do daily surveys of the creeks. We look for amphibians and reptiles in the wild. And then the day ends with campers touching and holding live amphibians. I think it's a really great experience. I think it's a lot of fun. And I think incredibly, it's great that we end up actually reaching over 330 campers every summer between the ages of 6 and 14. Let's talk about another role that I have. Another role that I've got is the collections manager, like you mentioned. In this particular role, I'm in charge of the care of our over 1,000 animals. So 100 of those animals are reptiles, and those are used strictly for education because reptiles are amazing. And, you know, we consider them part of herpetology. So not only do we study amphibians, but we also teach about reptiles too. But the remaining 900 animals that we have are amphibians. And those are either used for research, conservation, or education. And so we have so many animals and I would not be able to take care of them on my own. So thankfully we have over 35 weekly volunteers that come in and help me look after the animals. So I manage the volunteers as well. So it's great that I have such a great dedicated group of volunteers, and we have actually a few staff members as well. But you mentioned, you know, like what a typical day looks like for me, and so that is a pretty busy one. I have a pretty busy day when it comes to being at the Amphibian Foundation. Typically, I arrive there at about 8:45 a.m. and I begin by assessing the health of our animals. You know, I check in each enclosure, do some health checks, and then by 9:30, our weekly volunteers start to arrive and working in their respective labs. You know, cleaning enclosures, assessing the health of the animals as well. We work really hard to make sure that the animals are fed and watered. We keep detailed notes on all of our animals. We've also got several endangered research animals that we have that are breeding for us. And happily enough, we spend a lot of our time caring for our offspring. So it feels really great to see that we are contributing to the survival of these species. But that's not the end of my day, surprisingly enough. After our animals are cared for, I begin working with my education staff to organize our upcoming education and outreach events. And our education and outreach calendar is actually pretty full. So not only do we work with schools and groups, but we actually host critter birthday parties. It's pretty fun because we get to provide a child or sometimes adult with a special birthday party filled with amphibians and reptiles. And last but not least, I also handle the finances for the company, and that's always fun too.
So the collection obviously is hundreds of animals. Now, obviously it's not hundreds of species, right? We're talking about multiple individuals of a given species, right? I mean, you keep obviously quite a diverse, you know, palette of species, but like how much of that is just volume? Like how many members of species, you know, A versus species B are you keeping?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me think about that for a moment, because we do have some amphibians that we've got a great number of. So now with our frosted flatwood salamanders, we have, you know, a certain number, like more, definitely more than the 30 that we started with. But right now we are working with gopher frogs, and we have 600 gopher frog tadpoles in our outdoor mesocosm. So, you know, that's definitely contributing to that larger number. But then we have other animals that we've only got one of each of those species, you know. So we've got, let's see, a crocodile lizard that he's the only one that we've got, and we love him so much. And his name is John.
And what other species are you working with? I mean, I don't necessarily, I mean, hundreds of animals, I can't get every one of them, but can you run us down through some of them that you're working with?
Sure. So like I said, we have our frosted flatwood salamanders. We have our gopher frog, which is Georgia's rarest frog. The striped newt, which is another imperiled species that we're working with. And then we also work with the blue spotted salamanders. Those are a fantastic little salamander, and they are actually found up in Long Island, and we're really happy to be able to work with those guys. Soon we hope to be working with the Pigeon Mountain salamanders. We've got our permitting ready to go for us to just collect some of those Pigeon Mountain salamanders, because that particular group of animals is only found on one side of one particular mountain in Georgia. So we want to make sure that we are doing our best to provide a captive assurance colony for that for that group of salamanders, just to make sure that they're protected. And then on top of that, we've got so many different education animals that we work with. We love animals like White's tree frogs. We've got tons of salamanders, tiger salamanders, spotted salamanders, slimy salamanders. Goodness, so many things. I can just go on for days. I don't want to bore you.
No, you're not boring me. It's, as a hobbyist, I have kept all different things since I'm about maybe 10 or 12 years old. So it's been close to 30 years for me. And I've kept so many different things over the years. And I've always had what I guess like I would consider like a moderately sized collection, usually around 30 seems to be my carrying capacity. And it's small stuff. I don't keep anything that's that massive. But like for me, I think a lot about the variety of different species that I've kept and how each one of them posed unique challenges and how I learned, my husbandry methods. I like to think have improved over time, and I've learned different things. Managing such a diverse number of species, it's got to be a lot of work. Obviously, when it comes to managing the collection, how do you do it? Because like for me, I come home from work, I spend an average, maybe about 45 minutes to an hour a day just dealing with my little pathetic collection compared to what you guys have. How do you manage that? Husbandry decisions, the maintenance, the breeding. I know you said you did a wellness check in the morning, but you've got a lot of volunteers that are doing stuff as well. So do they do you and Mark have like a plan, like protocols for each species, or how do you get the volunteers up to speed in terms of, which animal needs which type of care, and how does it work?
That's a great question. So every different animal in each enclosure has its own animal sheet. So it's got its own inventory sheet. So that's one of the ways that we take care of managing, which animals in which enclosure, what's happening with this particular animal. Is there anything of note to, make mention of? So on each sheet, we've got, the name of the species, genus, species, the enclosure number, whether or not that animal has been sexed, whether or not we can tell if we've got a male or a female, or if it's still undetermined, and then general care for that animal, what it its preferred food items are. And so we're able to keep detailed records on each particular animal. And so that's one of the ways that we manage the collection, just because we have so many animals and each animal has its own specific needs. There are some similarities that some of the animals do have. So we've got, 10 different types of salamanders, maybe 7 of them like to live in a certain type way. And, we can make notations of that and make sure that we are keeping those animals in that way. Basically, our husbandry decisions are made through a collaboration between Mark, myself, and our veterinarian. We look at each individual species, figure out what they need. We make tweaks as we find different things as they come about. One thing that we found was our flatwood salamanders, our frosted flatwood salamanders, like to come out of their hiding places at night and take a dip in their little water pools. And we did not know that until our veterinarian actually took one to her facility and had a camera on it 24 hours, all day long for about a week's period, just so she could monitor its behavior, make sure that it was eating and, living its best life. And, come to find out that this animal was using its water source, and we really had no idea. So that changed our protocols in our labs. And so we were able then to provide water bowls for, you know, for our salamanders that needed them. So that's just kind of one example of how we kind of make some, you know, tweaks and make our decisions about husbandry and maintenance.
How was it getting a veterinarian? Because, I mean, the veterinary field is advancing to the point where more and more are dealing with exotics. You know, avian medicine is a thing, but mm-hmm. amphibian medicine is still kind of a frontier. How was it getting someone on board who was familiar with all this and, you know, familiar with amphibians enough to be able to, you know, make it a substantial part of a career?
It was not easy finding a great amphibian and reptile veterinarian. Like you said, you know, there are a few niche people that, you know, are into exotics. But by and large, most veterinarians are focusing more towards dogs and cats and general pet type animals. But we had the extreme fortune of finding this one amazing veterinarian. And she's been working with us for quite some time now. And, you know, like we really could not have done what we've done with our animals and kept them as healthy as they are without her help.
And what about feeding everything? Because that's a lot of mouths to feed. That was the thing that was keeping me up at night, was wondering how you managed to feed this, you know, like the frog army almost. How do you manage that?
Yeah, it's so many animals. There's so many mouths to feed. And so, like I said, we've got 35 volunteers that come in on a weekly basis that are like 100% dedicated to being there every week. Some we have that come in more than once a week, which I find amazing. And then we do have a few staff members, which I'm happy to say are, you know, there as well, right there on the front lines with us. So between the about 40 of us that we've got on hand, we're able to feed all 1,000 of our animals. So it's very deliberate. We have an inverticulturist, that's a word that we came up with on our own because we had to figure out what we were going to call the person that dealt with our bugs. So as you can imagine, we've got all of these mouths to feed, and so many of them eat bugs and little tiny insects and things that, you know, most people think are gross. But we have a person that, you know, comes in specifically to take care of our bugs and our bug collection and make sure that we have the healthiest bugs to feed off to our animals and make sure our animals are healthy.
What are some of the feeder insects that you are using? Because you've got, I mean, such, like, as it's so many different species, it's not like everything can necessarily exist off of one prey item. Like, what are some of the exactly. insects that you keep?
Yeah, one of the biggest that we use is crickets. We use banded crickets. Those are a pretty great source of protein for a lot of our animals. Also, dubia roaches. I know a lot of people are not fans of roaches. In general, I'm not a big fan of roaches either in my home, like as infestation animals. But when it comes to dubia roaches, they're actually really great for feeder insects. Also, we have superworms. We've got a lot of our reptiles that love superworms, and they're full of nutrition. We also have blackworms. They're not really insects, but more worm-like. So we've got blackworms, we've got white worms, and what other things do we have? That might be everybody. I might be leaving somebody out, but I think that's about everybody. Oh, wait, no, we've got fruit flies as well. Fruit flies are huge.
You read my mind.
Yeah, fruit flies. Can't forget those.
Now, I don't know. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but how many fruit fly cultures are you making per week?
That's a great question. Oh my gosh, so many. We're making about 25 to 30 cultures a week of fruit flies. So, and we've got two species, Melanogaster and Hydei. So we're making a lot of fruit flies every week.
Do you guys have a preference in terms of one or the other, in terms of like long-term ease of use and sustainability? I'll preface this by saying I used to do both. I used to do Melanogaster and Hydei, and then I got sick of Hydei. Anybody who like works with Hydei, I don't even have to explain it, but did you guys have a preference, or like, how does it keep in the two species?
Yeah. So I think the main reason why we have both species is because we've got some little mouths to feed. And so not all of them can eat our larger fruit flies. So we have to grow both to make sure that we can feed all of our little ones.
Gotcha. And you have dart frogs too, right? Or last time I...
Yes.
Okay. Which species do you have?
Yes, we sure do. Oh my gosh, I love all of our dart frogs. So we've got our Anthonii's and our Terribilis poison frog. We've got several species of Tinctorius. So we've got Azurius. I've got to love those little blue guys. We've also got the Tautus, as well as, let's see, I'm forgetting somebody. I can't think of our last one, but we've got those guys, definitely.
Do you ever incorporate those into the education aspect of it? Like, I want to get more into the education stuff in a little bit, but I know dart frogs are just such a visual thing. Like, do you ever incorporate them as a visual?
We definitely do. So that's one thing that we're going to be highlighting even more this summer at Critter Camp. So like I was kind of mentioning, at Critter Camp, we've got our animals set up in our classroom for the kids to learn about all week long. And so every year we come up with a different rotation of animals that we'll have as classroom animals. And this year I really want to focus on poison frogs, dart frogs, you know, because they're just so amazing. They're so brightly colored. They always want to be out. They'll always eat for you. And so one of our biggest things that we do at Critter Camp in the morning, our first activity, is called feeding and observation time. So the kids are learning how to feed the animals and then watching them eat, and then with their scientific journals, either drawing or writing down what they're seeing. And so for these particular dart frogs, I'm really excited to have them there as classroom animals for the kids to feed them their delicious fruit flies and, you know, watch them just like be excited about them, come and pick them off, and, you know, have the kids watch the frogs eating these, you know, fully delicious fruit flies.
It's got to be amazing, especially for people who haven't seen it before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I have one more question though about the day-to-day maintenance and the husbandry of the collection. Obviously, sure. Amphibians are sensitive to water parameters, and you guys mm-hmm. have hundreds of them. What do you do in terms of sourcing water? Do you have like a purification system for the building? Do you go off of like city water? How do you guys manage the water quality?
We are super careful when it comes to the water, because like you said, amphibians are, you know, 100% susceptible to the water that they interact with. So we have our filtration system that we use. Then we have our RO water filtration as well. So we've got that. Plus we keep a reservoir of aged tannic water for our more sensitive species as well. So we're constantly making sure that filters are being changed and just making sure that the amphibians get the best water possible.
And what about supplies? Because obviously, you know, you guys are a not-for-profit. Do you have a preference for like a certain types of supplies, like certain types of filters or lights or whatnot, or do you just kind of go with whatever, I guess, goes in the budget or whatever gets donated, or how does that work out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, we do have specific preferences for certain things. It could be something that could be considered kind of a small detail, but we go through a ton of paper towels on a weekly basis. So most people, when they think of paper towels, they're just like, oh, I'll just get whatever is here or maybe what's on sale. But we consistently get Viva paper towels, and it's the signature cloth. It cannot be the new and improved, like new cloth that they have, but it is the Viva signature cloth that is the 100% best paper towel that we have found. And so we strictly use that paper towel. I guess this could be a Viva commercial, but that's just one of the products that we stand behind complete. And then we've got a few other items that we are very specific about. And so, I don't want to name drop too much, but basically we do have some favorites. But then at the same time, sometimes, if there's a light bulb that we cannot find from our preferred source, we will, go to a secondary source if we need to.
How did the paper towel decision? Because I mean, it's honestly, it is an important decision because I'm very specific with some of the stuff that I like to use too, to the point of being like really neurotic. There's just certain products I just won't use at all. What was, I mean, this is for not just like cleaning. Well, what is it for? I mean, is it for cleaning tanks? Is it for using as a substrate for species that need it? Like, what was the motivation to use the paper towels in the first place?
We use our paper towels for substrates for some of our amphibians. So, I and so when I say we only use Viva paper towels, I mean, of course for cleaning as well, but the whole thought process behind getting those paper towels was that they are absorbent in such a way that they retain moisture for our specific amphibians that we have them on. So those are generally our education animals that we have on paper towels in their enclosure, and we use them because it's easy for cleanup. And so like I said, it's just the right absorbency for maintaining correct moisture levels in the enclosures. And then cleanup is super easy, and it just makes everything better.
I'm gonna have to try them now. I'm intrigued.
Yes, you have to try them. They're amazing.
I feel like if the Amphibian Foundation gives it like the gold seal of approval, then then I can get behind it. No, but
Yeah, definitely.
I agree with you. There's certain things that just tend to work, and like people will ask me, "Why are you so committed to this?" And I said, "Well, I'm committed to it because it works. I'm happy with the results. I
Works.
like a certain thing." And
Yeah.
even like when it comes down to something like cypress mulch, I've prattled on, over the past few years about this like magical cypress mulch that I used to get in the early 2000s. I can't get it anymore. That was the best
Yeah.
cypress mulch, and the stuff I get now, I'm just not happy with it. It doesn't hold moisture the same way. It's
Yeah.
more like the whatever you call it, like the not the grain size, but like the chunks of mulch are not as big, and it's I don't know, it's I don't know, I shouldn't complain, but
Well, these things
yeah,
matter.
they
These things
do.
matter. Yeah. And when you mention, other substrates like our sphagnum moss that we get, we only go with sphagnum moss. And they're just an amazing company. They do an amazing job and we love them. And so like that's the moss that we always get. If we can't get that, we're in horrible straits if we can't find that moss. So that and the Viva paper towels, I will also say they're fantastic when you have to, let's say, if you have an aquatic tank, because this has happened to us, unfortunately, in the past, where we had one of our thermometers break inside a tank. And so I had to remove all of the amphibians from that tank, drain the tank completely, and then make sure that every morsel of that thermometer was removed. And so I had to dry the tank completely And that Viva paper towel did wonders. So I've got to say, like, all across the board, Viva is number one.
I have to try it. So the outreach and education program, I know this is a really big deal, because it's one thing to have a conservation organization that breeds endangered animals, has a protocol to reintroduce them, and keep an insurance colony. It's another thing altogether to have an outreach program incorporated to that, where you engage members of the public, you engage people in the community. How did that become, how did that become something that you guys wanted to do? Obviously, we talked about starting off in your basement, basically, and then getting a facility. What made you make the transition into educational and outreach programs, as opposed to just doing the assurance colony breeding stuff?
Well, it's actually only through our education and outreach programs that we're able to keep the Amphibian Foundation running. So our model for our business is a self-sustaining one, but we do rely on the community for our, like, membership programs to help fund our conservation initiatives. But it became really clear early on in the inception of the foundation that we couldn't rely on quote unquote soft money, generally because most funders don't prioritize amphibians, unfortunately. So we found that we had to fund ourselves. So this led us to offering classes to raise money. Funny enough, Critter Camp is the only educational program that we have that actually predates the Amphibian Foundation. Mark and I created Critter Camp as just this summer camp for kids, because we had young kids at the time, and we had a collection of animals that, you know, we wanted to do something exciting with. So we came up with the idea of Critter Camp. And so for us, education and teaching just kind of made sense for us. So when COVID hit in 2020, we completely had to kind of revamp our educational offerings, and we ended up going 100% virtual, and that changed everything for us. So on one hand, it was unfortunate that we were no longer able to interact with people face to face. But on the other hand, we were able to reach the entire world now with our message. And that's been completely life changing. So now we can say we're international, and we have students and staff now from all around the world. But our education and outreach program has been everything to us.
When I took the class, the master herpetologist class, I think it was in 2020, and I was just really, really impressed by how sophisticated a class it was. And I know Mark had experience teaching at a university level, and that was what I got out of it. I felt like I was auditing a college class, because it's not like you guys put out classes that were very, very basic. You put out stuff that was very, very in detail and extremely engaging and high level.
Thank you.
Why decide to go that route as opposed to something that was more like simple? Like, why get so immersive with the material?
Well, Mark is just amazing. And he's really got that, biology minded mind. And, he wants to be really just kind of immersed in the science. And he loves everything about amphibians, and he wants to teach everybody about amphibians. And so when we were discussing what we were going to do in 2020 when COVID hit, we're like, oh my gosh, we have to cancel everything that's in person. What are we going to do? How is the Amphibian Foundation going to persist? And we're like, we're going to have to just do everything virtually. So if it's going to be virtual, what's the level that we want to bring to this? So, Mark was just really convinced that having the best minds in the field contributing to this class was going to be the way to go. So hopefully, Dan, you got the experience when you took the class, the Master of Herpetology class, that you were being taught by, you know, people that knew what they were talking about and were excited to give their lectures and convey the information that they had. I think that it's an amazing class. And then actually, it's now become an entire suite of classes. So depending on what your interests are, you can kind of branch out in any kind of way, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm online looking right now. And you've got a new class. You've got Captive Husbandry and Management. You've also got a Southeastern Master Herpetologist course, the original Master Herp, Master Herp 2, and you've got a Conservation Edition. And yes. That's just what I can see right in front of me now. So you've definitely got quite a few different course offerings.
Yes, Mark has been very busy putting these courses together. But it's been a labor of love for him. But he actually doesn't sleep very much as a result. He's been doing a lot of work.
I can only imagine that that's got to be a whole big thing in of itself. But you have a hands-on approach, right? You like to be engaging with people, like, you know, there in the moment, the critter camp and whatnot. Tell us about some of the programs that you do personally. Like, we'll start us off with the critter camp. I mean, as much detail as you can get into, someone who's looking to get involved with this, you know, what can they expect? You know, how do you register? I mean, this is something that you guys advertise in the community. Like, how do you get people started at that age level?
Yes. So our critter camp ranges in age from 6 to 14. And then we break that down into two age groups. So we have our ages 6 to 9 and then ages 10 to 14. We hold critter camp at two separate locations. So our Amphibian Foundation location in Buckhead. And then our second location is actually located in Decatur at the Friends School of Atlanta. And so we advertise through our website, which is critter-camp.org. And we actually also advertise for it on our Amphibian Foundation website as well, which is amphibianfoundation.org. So each website kind of goes into detail about, you know, what to expect on a regular day at Critter Camp. And so on our Critter Camp website, you're able to register right there. And it's a week-long camp. It runs Monday through Friday. And each day we talk about a different animal group. So the first day is Salamander Day. And that's the day that we talk about, you know, what is a salamander? But before we are even able to talk about what a salamander is, we have to first talk about what an amphibian is, because not everybody knows what an amphibian is. So we discuss what an amphibian is, what makes up an amphibian. You know, it's the important characteristics in their skin and all of these other wonderful things. Our second day is Frog Day, and we go into detail about all the different kinds of frogs that are out there. Our third day is Turtle Day, and kids get to see and meet lots of different kinds of turtles, some great snake neck turtles that have these super long necks. And then we've got, you know, other kind of turtles like box turtles that are able to pull their heads and whole bodies into their shells and completely kind of hide from the world. Our Thursday is Lizard Day. And our fifth day is Snake Day. Snake Day is the best day because we get to talk about snakes and handle snakes. And so it's just a really fantastic time. We spend a lot of time, like I said, learning how to take care of the animals that are in the classroom. We have two lessons each day. The first lesson kind of talks about the animal group that we're learning about that particular day. So on day one, what is a salamander? What is an amphibian? And then our second lesson talks about the diversity of that animal group. So we'll talk about, you know, what kinds of salamanders are out there. There are axolotls. You know, nobody thinks about axolotls as salamanders. But we've got, you know, slimy salamanders, spotted salamanders, tiger salamanders. And we talk all about them and talk about the different characteristics of each type of animal. And then we go outside, for amphibian and reptile surveys of the creek that's right there on the premises, which is so much fun. The kids get to splash around a little bit, look for amphibians, flip logs. We find so many different things out there, which is so fantastic. And then at the end of the day, we end up handling the animals that we just spent that whole day learning about. So on snake day, we've just learned about all the different kinds of snakes that are out there. So that means that we bring in 6 different kinds of snakes for the kids to see. So we'll start off with maybe some small king snakes and maybe work our way up to an indigo snake, which is one of Georgia's endangered snakes, which we love teaching our kids about. And then we kind of move all the way up to Burmese pythons and our green anaconda, Sylvester. So, you know, it's just a fantastic time. The kids get to meet lots of different animals, and we just are completely immersed in the world of amphibians and reptiles.
And what about, I'm not saying like older, like 14 is old, but like people who are, you know, older, out of high school, college, whatever, or even, you know, adults, what kind of programs do you offer that might interest people in a, you know, an older dynamic?
Definitely. In our older dynamic, we've got our virtual programs for the most part, like you were mentioning, our master herpetology class and the suite of classes in there. We also have done something that's been a lot of fun, something that's called Critters and Cabernet. It was basically for our adults who were thinking, hey, my kid goes to critter camp. I wish there was an adult critter camp. And so Mark and I were like, you know what? We can make an adult critter camp. We can do that, and we'll make it even more adult and add some wine to that. So that was a lot of fun, and probably be bringing that back around. We had to discontinue that during COVID, but we're very much looking forward to bringing Critters and Cabernet back. We also have our Conservation Research Bridge program. Mark may have spoken about it with you before, but this is for individuals aged 18 and up. And it's for people looking either to learn about the field of herpetology, or perhaps maybe change their current field to the field of herpetology, or just kind of get into a little bit more of the mindset of what a herpetologist is and what they do. And so a person would be able to come to the Research Bridge program for between 1 to 3 semesters and spend time with us, either part-time or full-time, just learning from amazing scientists that we have working with us. So we've got an urban ecologist that works with us, a disease ecologist that works with us, just amazing people that are showing them, you know, what a career in herpetology could look like, if that's something that you're interested in.
And what do you look for in a volunteer if someone wants to, because I mean, there's a lot of day-to-day stuff. Like we talked about, you know, just feeding the animals and whatnot. A lot of it can be not necessarily glamorous. You have to be willing to kind of do the dirty work. What do you look for in terms of a volunteer? Like say someone just shows up, you know, at the front door and says, hey, I want to volunteer. What do you look for? Like, do you have to come in with experience, or do you guys train? What constitutes like a good volunteer candidate for you?
Well, we don't expect anybody to come in with any sort of experience whatsoever. So we treat everybody as a blank slate. And so if you come in and you happen to have a little bit of knowledge about amphibians or reptiles, that is just a plus. It's definitely not a requirement in any sort of way. So really all we're looking for is a person who loves amphibians and or reptiles, is excited to come in and be around other like-minded individuals who will most likely want to talk to you about amphibians and reptiles, and be able to commit weekly, because that's a really big thing, actually being able to commit weekly to a particular lab and come in and be detail oriented and be communicative and friendly. That's what we look for. We look for friendly people that are dedicated to the health and safety of our amphibians and reptiles.
And as far as the animals go, obviously ambassador animals are an important part of this because that's the visual, the hands-on approach. So hear me out on this, because I want to hear what your thoughts are. Amphibians as good candidates for ambassador animals. All right. Once a year I do a little community outreach thing. Outreach. Sorry. No, there's no community outreach. Not yet. I do a little community outreach at my daughter's elementary school, but I mean, she's graduating this year from there, so that'll be the last year. But basically the premise is parents from the community come in, talk about something that they enjoy, a skill, whatever. So I bring in the frogs, and I always have to bring in something for a little bit of like an extra wow factor, because the frogs are colorful, but they're small. I mean, even the pixie frog. So I bring my bearded dragon and I explain, all right, he's not an amphibian, but when the kids see something that's large, you know, that you can hold in your hands, it's more of a, I guess it's like more of a captivating effect than just the little frogs and their little deli cups. What are your thoughts on ambassador animals? Because obviously you guys do incorporate reptiles as well as amphibians. What do you look for in an ambassador animal? Do you prefer something that's a little bit bigger and more visual, or how do you negotiate deciding, you know, what's going to work best for your audience?
Yeah, ambassador animals are super important because, of course, you know, if a person is able to associate a particular animal with a specific cause, you know, that cause ends up meaning so much more to those people. So when they see a really brightly colored frog, they're like, oh, that's amazing. Let's make sure that we keep our water clean. Let's make sure that, you know, we're doing our part to make sure that these animals have what they need. I would say it's not always the largest animal that's the most impressive, although large is great sometimes. But, you know, a lot of times we have animals that have amazing color patterns, amazing camouflage abilities, amazing textures to their skin. And so when a person is able to get close up and see these animals for, you know, what they are and see those amazing attributes, you know, it's really kind of eye-opening and really just fascinating, because people are like, oh, I didn't know that this mossy frog had this amazing texture to it. You know, not only does it, you know, look like moss, but, you know, it kind of feels a little mossy also. Also, we've got one of our favorite ambassador animals, if you ever get a chance to meet Duchess. Duchess is an amazing, wonderful cane toad. She's super huge, just shy of the world record for size, but she's amazing. And if you ever get to meet her, you'll never forget her. She's definitely one of the ones that you would say, you know, would be impressive for her size. But not only the large ones are the best, but, you know, some of the little guys are pretty amazing too.
Yeah, you have to have something that has that wow factor, I guess.
Yeah, wow factor is good.
how did she get the name? I mean, that's an awesome name, but how did she get the name Duchess?
Oh, gosh, that was a Mark name. He just looked at her and said, that looks like a duchess. She's royalty. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you have so many different roles. We've talked about all of them. I mean, on an average day, or I shouldn't say, and at the end of the day, which roles are the most challenging and which ones are the most rewarding?
I would say the most challenging role at the foundation is dealing with the finances. Of course, because, you know, finding funding sources is always a big deal. And we can always use more money and more funding. So allocating funds to the right initiatives definitely keeps me on my toes. But, you know, it's just a must. So must be done. So I'm happy to do it. But then I would say my most rewarding roles are being the director of education and being the collections manager. I love teaching kids and the public about amphibians and reptiles because, you know, seeing a child hold their first frog or first salamander or first snake, that's the best experience ever. You know, their faces just kind of light up and the sense of wonderment is just so infectious. And then being the collections manager is great because I get the opportunity to be surrounded by amazing, incredible animals and people that, you know, love these animals, and I get to spend all day long with them. So it's really fantastic, and I couldn't be happier doing it.
And what are some goals for the future? Where do you look to be in the next, say, 5 years or 10 years with the programs that you run?
Well, we definitely want to expand our education and outreach team and our program even further. So we want to engage with as many people as possible to spread the message of conservation. So this is Critter Camp's 9th year, but we're hoping for at least 20 more, you know, I guess, you know, at least five to 10 more. That would be great. And we also want to grow our Conservation Research Bridge program. Like I was saying a little bit earlier ago, you know, it's for people, you know, 18 and up, you know, just looking to get more knowledge about herpetology. And so we want to see that program grow. Like right now we have the capacity for 8 students a semester, but we want to get to the point where we could have, you know, 15, 20, 30 students at a time. That would be fantastic. So those are just a few areas that we'd love to grow in.
Are there any new species that you'd like to have the opportunity to work with in the near future?
Ooh, wow, that's a great question. Mark always asks me that. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know. Where would we put them? That's the question. We have to figure out where they would go. But there are definitely a few animals that I would love to work with more. We've got two species of glass frog currently, but there are actually a few more species of glass frog that I would really love to work with because they're just so amazing and just like they're mind-boggling to me, just being able to see everything that's going on inside them. And then let's see, maybe work with a few more amazing newts, because we've gotten some great newts in the past, and their whole life cycle is just amazing to me. You know, some of them that go from the water to land back to the water, and it's just amazing. So probably those guys. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite animal? Like if you had to just pick one out of the hundreds that you have, if you could pick one species, what would it be?
Goodness. Oh my goodness. Dan, what are you doing to me over here? Making me choose one animal. That's crazy. I don't know. Gosh, what's my favorite animal? Okay, well, I have one particular animal that has my heart. He is he's an Asian snapping turtle. He's a big head Asian snapping turtle. And he's actually been in our collection for quite some time. He's actually about 40 years old. And his name is Soup. He has kind of like a macabre name because his species has kind of been eaten into extinction, unfortunately. But I love him so much, and he's got this sweet little puppy dog face, and he is a snapping turtle, and he would love nothing more than to bite me. But I know that we have a mutual love for each other, and I will say he's my favorite.
Yeah, I've seen them. They look almost prehistoric. They've got these massive heads that look like the skull is kind of on the outside.
Yes, they are the only species that actually have shell on their heads. It's amazing.
Really? That's I always wondered what that was.
Yep, that is Shell.
Yeah. And the mutual respect thing is interesting because, yeah, you're right. Sometimes you, because I keep reptiles as well. And sometimes you kind of get an idea after a while when an animal's kind of like not in the mood to be bothered.
Yes.
And
yes.
Yeah. And you open up that door and it's like, please don't bite me. And,
yeah.
And the snakes I have, I mean, it's nothing major, but they're on eye level. So of course, you know, where do they go? They go for the face.
Yes, right for the face.
even the one that's on the ground goes for the face. My king snake I've had for like 22 years. He always goes, wow. I don't know. He goes for the face. He's a jerk, but I don't know. That's how they are. So, I mean, we're kind of at the end, but I wanted to just ask you if anybody wanted to become involved, anybody wanted to become a volunteer or was interested in some of the critter camps or whatnot, how would people get involved with some of the stuff that you offer?
Yeah, definitely. Oh my goodness. We would love that. We would love people to, you know, to inquire about volunteering. We're always looking for volunteers. Of course, as you can imagine, you know, everything is seasonal. So at the end of semesters, people are changing their schedules and, you know, some people are leaving and a lot of our volunteers are students. So we welcome everybody as volunteers. So ages 18 and up, you're welcome, please, to volunteer. You can reach out to us. You can go to our website, amphibianfoundation.org. Also, if you're interested, if your listeners are interested in registering for Critter Camp, they can go to critter-camp.org. We've also got an opportunity for people to become members. And so it's always fantastic when people are able to join as members, because that just helps us from day to day to raise money and make sure that we have enough funds to keep our doors open. And of course, if you're looking to volunteer, if you want to reach out to us via email, you can email us at info@amphibianfoundation.org. Please reach out. We definitely want to hear from everyone and anyone.
Well, that's great. And I mean, I can tell everybody out there listening, if you haven't taken the Master Herpetologist course, if you want to just, you know, up your game and become really familiar with a lot of the species that most of us keep, most of us work with, native species, non-native species, if you're outside of the U.S., I guess they would all be non-native species. But it was a lot of fun. And I do know a lot of listeners who have taken the course. I know people like to, you know, put pictures of their certificate up online. And it's a good course. It's high level. It's like, to my opinion, it's on par with a college course. And I got a lot out of it. I really enjoyed it. And I have, you know, I'm happy to recommend that class to anybody who's interested in learning more about reptiles and amphibians in a lot of detail. You're going to learn stuff that you never would have imagined. So I give you guys a lot of credit for that class too. That was a win. I really loved it.
Thank you so much, Dan. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean,
definitely do.
Yeah.
Yes. And we always love to see when our students post their certificates. You know, like they'll send us their pictures and we'll post it on our social media. We're so happy to do that. We're just glad that people are proud, you know, to be, you know, certified master herpetologists. So thank you for promoting us. We appreciate that.
Yeah. It's a good thing. It is. Like, and I mean, everybody knows I just being completely honest. I'm just doing this of my own free will. It was a great class. I enjoyed it. I still have the notebook. I made a binder. I kept notes, a lot of fun projects. We made a conservation poster online. It was a lot of fun. And there's a husbandry class coming up.
There is.
And there's a lot
Gotta
of good,
take that next.
Yeah. And there's a couple of people who've actually been on the show, I think, are involved in that too.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
a small world.
I think Mike Novy was involved.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love Mike Novy.
Yeah, Mike's I love Mike too. I usually have Mike on every couple of months and he's great. Mike's like, what I love about Mike is and if Mike, you're listening, you're awesome. I love you.
we love you, Mike.
I just asked Mike, I said, all right, just tell us about XYZ, and Mike can just tell you so much about any species and never repeat himself. You know, he's just, he just can tell you over, you know, just go on and on about everything about husbandry, about, you know, history and the hobby, whatnot. And he's just like, he's a fountain of knowledge.
Amazing. Yes, you're right.
And that was also was nice about the husbandry class. It was being taught by people who are, you know, in the hobby, and people who manage collections, and people who are breeders, which I thought was, I to me, it was unique. It was something that I've never seen before. And I think to have it presented the way that the Amphibian Foundation presents all the other classes on the high level was something that will benefit anybody who's interested.
Thank you so much for saying that. Yeah, it's fantastic to be able to learn from the people that are actually doing it, you know? I think that's what sets it apart.
And there's so many more people involved in this, and, you know, the internet and whatnot has made it, and I know I sound like I'm like 1,000 years old, but I mean, like, you know, you, me, Mark, we're kind of in the same, you know, we grew up before the internet. And it's amazing how much you have accessible to you nowadays that just wasn't there. Like when I was 13 years old, I would have killed for something like this, but we didn't have it. And now we do.
Yeah. And that's what I hear all the time now, you know, when I'm, you know, talking to people about Critter Camp, you know, that are older, you know, people that are in their 30s, 40s, even in their 20s, they're like, you know, I wish that we had something like this when I was a kid. And I'm like, that's why we're doing it, because we didn't have this when we were kids, and we know what it would have meant to us to have it.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And even the number of species, like, I don't know if you remember, you know, before, you know, everything like pre-2000, but in any kind of reptile, I mean, very rarely did you see amphibians other than maybe like a big bullfrog or a cane toad or something similar. But now, I mean, glass frogs, I only saw glass frogs in a book when I was a kid, and now they're, you know, people keep them in captivity and keep them well too.
Exactly. Yeah. People are learning more and more about them, and people are getting excited about them. So, you know, it's really our hope that people are going to, you know, be excited about them and want to make sure that they continue to persist. And we have to just do our part.
Yeah. That's I don't think you could, I couldn't have put it better myself. That's perfect. That's the best way of putting it.
Thank you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. All right, everyone. I want to thank Crystal for taking the time to talk to us about just, you know, all that goes into the Amphibian Foundation. And I love hearing about the behind the scenes stuff and everything that goes into it, because operating in an organization like this, there's a lot of work to it. And, you know, I can tell you from experience volunteering at, you know, other not-for-profits myself, it takes a lot of work. And, you know, again, if anybody out there is listening, you're in the Atlanta area, I guess you want to, you know, volunteer in person, take the classes. I'll be honest with you, the classes are great. Take the classes. You won't regret it. So other than that, again, I want to thank Crystal from, you know, the Amphibian Foundation for talking to us tonight. I want to thank you guys for listening, of course, and I will catch up with you again next time.